You are listening to This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine offers news from a Palestinian perspective. The following hour may contain views that do not necessarily reflect those of WZBC Boston College or its Board of Trustees.
Mom, can you hear me? Mom, I'm so sorry, Mom. I didn't want to leave you, but I had to help them. I had to go. Mom, please forgive me if I don't come back. I chose this path, a path of healing, a path of love. They're shooting at us, Mom. They see the lights, they hear the sirens, but they don't care. No, they don't care. My friends are gone, the witnesses too. No one left to tell the truth. Mom, I don't wanna leave you. Mom, forgive me. Mom, forgive me for choosing this path. They killed the reporters. They killed the journalists. Now they're turning their guns on me. Mom, I think it's my time. When you find my body, bury me next to Dad and little sis, right on our graves. They stood for what was right.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. This is your guest host, Bethany Marks. Welcome to This Week in Palestine. Today is April 20th, 2025. The conflict between Israel and Hamas that erupted on October 7, 2023, represents one of the most devastating escalations in the region's history, leaving profound humanitarian, political, and social consequences. It began with a highly organized and unprecedented attack by Hamas, which included infiltrations into occupied territories by land, sea, and air. This attack resulted in the loss of over 1,200 lives, primarily Israeli civilians, marking the deadliest single day for Israel since its establishment in 1948. As more details emerged, questions began to arise about the truth behind the reported casualties. Allegations surfaced that claims of atrocities, such as the killing of children, infants, and acts of sexual violence, were fabricated by Israeli sources to present a narrative in which Israel appeared to be the victim. These stories were widely disseminated by the media, shaping international perceptions of the conflict. Subsequent reports suggested that Israeli soldiers had been ordered to kill indiscriminately, including hostages, to ensure that no hostages were taken by Hamas. This revelation added another layer of complexity to the narrative surrounding the events of October 7. The scale and coordination of the attack initially shocked Israel, but the fabricated narratives and misinformation that followed also stunned the international community, leading many to align themselves with Israel's side of the story without critically questioning the details. Israel's response was immediate and formidable, declaring a state of war against Hamas and initiating a series of military operations targeting Gaza. These operations involved widespread airstrikes, artillery bombardments, and eventually a ground invasion of the territory. The destruction was catastrophic, with residential areas reduced to rubble, hospitals, and schools rendered inoperable and key infrastructure wiped out. By January 2024, thousands of Palestinians had lost their lives, and the humanitarian situation in Gaza reached unprecedented levels of crisis. Access to food, clean water, medical supplies, and electricity became nearly non-existent, and the displacement of civilians escalated to staggering numbers, with millions forced to seek refuge in overcrowded shelters or neighboring regions. Throughout 2024, international efforts to mediate a ceasefire intermittently paused the conflict, but the underlying tensions remained unresolved. By March 2025, hostilities had resumed with renewed intensity. Israel's military expanded its operations, focusing on seizing large portions of Gaza's territory, further displacing residents and exacerbating the already dire conditions. These actions have been widely criticized, with Palestinians accusing Israel of attempting a land grab under the guise of military strategy. Meanwhile, Hamas continued to launch rocket attacks into Palestinian-occupied lands by Israel, leading to additional casualties and destruction. The impact of the war extends far beyond the immediate violence. For Palestinians, the conflict has deepened the sense of despair and hopelessness, as generations grow up under siege, facing restricted movement, limited access to resources, and the constant threat of violence. The blockade of Gaza, enforced by Israel since 2007, has intensified the suffering, preventing the flow of humanitarian aid and trapping civilians in what many describe as an open-air prison. On the Israeli side, the conflict has reinforced fears about security and terrorism, with settlers living under the shadow of rocket sirens and the constant risk of attack. International reactions to the conflict have been mixed, reflecting the deep divisions over how to address the situation. While some nations and organizations have called for an immediate ceasefire and condemned the loss of civilian life on both sides, others have expressed strong support for Israel's right to defend itself against Hamas. The United Nations, human rights groups, and various NGOs have repeatedly highlighted potential violations of international law, including the targeting of civilian infrastructure and disproportionate use of force. The situation remains highly volatile, with no clear resolution in sight. The human cost of the war measured in lives lost, communities destroyed, and futures disrupted is immense. As the world watches, the need for meaningful intervention and a path to lasting peace becomes increasingly urgent. Yet, the ongoing cycle of violence, political gridlock, and deeply rooted animosities pose significant barriers to achieving stability. The barbaric attack that has destroyed most of Gaza. Since the escalation of hostilities, over 50,000 Palestinians have been killed, including approximately 18,000 children, due to Israeli airstrikes and military operations. In recent attacks, at least 414 Palestinians, including 174 children, were killed in a single night of airstrikes. The United Nations has documented that many of these strikes targeted residential buildings and tents for displaced people, leading to significant civilian casualties. Among these killed, there is 173 journalists and media workers have lost their lives, making it one of the deadliest conflicts for journalists in modern history. Additionally, 22 humanitarian aid workers, including paramedics, have been killed, with 179 of them being UNRWA employees. These figures highlight the devastating toll on those trying to document or provide aid during the conflict. The deliberate targeting of journalists by Israeli forces reveals a calculated attempt to suppress dissent and control the narrative surrounding the ongoing conflict. By killing reporters and, in most cases, their families, Israel sends a harrowing message that even those holding cameras or microphones, documenting the realities on the ground, are not exempt from violence. This strategy not only undermines press freedom, but also instills fear among reporters, dissuading them from revealing the truth about the humanitarian crises, war crimes, and suffering in Gaza. The deaths of journalists have a silencing effect, muting critical voices that might expose injustices to the international community. What is equally troubling is the lack of a unified and strong response to these actions. Few voices have risen to challenge this blatant assault on press freedom, and journalist syndicates, the institutions meant to protect and defend the rights of their members, have remained largely silent. This failure to speak out not only leaves journalists vulnerable, but also erodes the principles of accountability and transparency in conflict reporting. It raises a troubling question. Why has the global community not done more to demand justice for the journalists who risk and lose their lives in pursuit of the truth? In the absence of meaningful objections, the situation continues to spiral. The tacit approval or indifference of the international community emboldens such actions, ensuring that journalists remain in harm's way, while the stories they aim to tell are buried in the rubble of Gaza. Protecting reporters is not just about safeguarding individuals. It is about upholding the right to information and ensuring that the world remains informed about the realities of war. Without their voices, the victims of these conflicts risk being forgotten, their stories untold, and justice elusive. The silence of those who should speak out, be it governments, international organizations, or journalist advocacy groups, makes them complicit in this suppression. This is not just a violation of press freedom. It is a direct assault on the ideals of justice, accountability, and truth. The world must do more than watch passively. It must act decisively to ensure that journalists are protected and that their sacrifices are not in vain. The targeting of journalists is not just a tragedy for the individuals lost, but a loss for humanity as a whole, as it diminishes our collective ability to bear witness to injustice and hold those responsible accountable. The tragedy of Hend Rajab, a 5-year-old Palestinian girl killed during the Israeli invasion of Gaza, sparked outrage and grief worldwide. However, the global response to her death and the broader humanitarian crisis in Gaza revealed stark contrasts between public sentiment and governmental actions. In the immediate aftermath, countries such as the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, France, and Italy took actions that many viewed as deeply troubling. Instead of advocating for accountability or addressing the humanitarian crisis, these nations sent additional ammunition and bombs to Israel under the guise of supporting its right to self-defense. This move was widely interpreted as a message to Israel that it could act with impunity, assured that these governments would not question its actions or demand accountability for civilian casualties, including the killing of Hend Rajab and her family. Meanwhile, public sentiment across the globe painted a different picture. In numerous countries, people took to the streets in protest, demanding justice for Palestinians and an end to the violence in Gaza. Demonstrations erupted in major cities, with activists and ordinary citizens expressing their outrage at the targeting of civilians and the destruction of Gaza. However, these protests were met with resistance from governments, many of which sought to suppress dissent. In Western nations, protesters faced restrictions, arrests, and censorship as authorities attempted to quell the growing wave of solidarity with Palestine. In Arab countries, the response was even more severe. Nations such as Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, and others cracked down on demonstrations, punishing those who dared to speak out against Israel's actions. In some cases, individuals were arrested simply for carrying a Palestinian flag or expressing support for Gaza. These measures highlighted the complex political dynamics in the region, where governments often prioritize diplomatic relations and alliances over the voices of their citizens. The tragedy of Hend Rajab and the subsequent global response underscore the deep divisions between public opinion and governmental policies. While many people around the world continue to advocate for justice and accountability, the actions of powerful nations and regional governments often serve to perpetuate the cycle of violence and silence those who seek change. Hend's story remains a poignant reminder of the urgent need for a unified and principled approach to addressing the humanitarian crisis in Gaza and ensuring that the voices of the oppressed are heard. The killing of Palestinian paramedics in Gaza has drawn widespread condemnation and raised serious concerns about the safety of humanitarian workers in conflict zones. Here's what is known. On March 23, 2025, Israeli forces targeted a group of paramedics and emergency responders near Rafah in the southern Gaza Strip. The team, which included members of the Palestinian Red Crescent, civil defense personnel, and a UN employee, was responding to distress calls from civilians injured in Israeli airstrikes. Despite being in clearly marked ambulances and wearing uniforms, they were fired upon. 15 humanitarian workers were killed, and their bodies were later found in a shallow grave. The Israeli military initially claimed that the vehicles approached their position suspiciously, without lights or markings, and alleged that militants were using the ambulances. However, video evidence recovered from one of the victims contradicted this account, showing the ambulances with their lights on and clearly marked. The sole survivor, Munthar Abed, confirmed that the vehicles were visibly marked as emergency response units. This incident has sparked calls for an independent investigation, with organizations like the UN and the Palestinian Red Crescent demanding accountability. The International Committee of the Red Cross emphasized that attacks on medical workers violate international humanitarian law. Israel, a nation often criticized for its actions in conflict zones, has once again drawn global attention for targeting humanitarian workers. These paramedics, whose sole mission was to save lives, became victims of violence themselves, a tragic irony that should shake the conscience of the world. Where is the international community in the face of such atrocities? The silence is deafening. The very institutions and nations that champion human rights and the rule of law seem paralyzed, unwilling or unable to hold Israel accountable. Is this the world we accept, a world where the lives of humanitarian workers are expendable and justice is a distant dream? This is not just a Palestinian issue, it is a human issue. The targeting of paramedics violates the core principles of international humanitarian law, which seeks to protect those who provide aid in times of conflict. The lack of global outrage and action sets a dangerous precedent, eroding the protections that countless humanitarian workers rely on to carry out their life-saving work. It is time for the world to wake up. The killing of these paramedics is not just a tragedy. It is a call to action. Governments, international organizations, and civil society must come together to demand accountability and ensure that such violations are never repeated. The question is not just why this happened, but why the world remains silent.
Mom, can you hear me? Mom, I'm so sorry, Mom. I didn't want to leave you.
You are listening to This Week in Palestine.
I had to go. Mom, please forgive me. If I don't come back, I chose this path.
Israel has been accused of numerous actions that some classify as violations of international law, sparking widespread criticism and ongoing debates. Among these are allegations of targeting civilians during military operations in Gaza and the West Bank, which often result in significant casualties, including women and children. The blockade of Gaza has been described by critics as a form of collective punishment, severely restricting the movement of goods and people, and exacerbating humanitarian crises. Additionally, Israel has faced accusations of forcibly displacing Palestinian families through the demolition of homes and the expansion of settlements in the West Bank, actions that are considered illegal under international law. Reports from human rights organizations have documented instances of excessive force used against civilians and protesters, leading to injuries and fatalities. Furthermore, all the attacks on hospitals, ambulances, and medical personnel during conflicts, raising concerns about the violation of protections guaranteed to humanitarian workers. These actions have drawn condemnation from various international bodies, prompting calls for investigations and accountability as the situation continues to fuel tension and conflict in the region. The ceasefire in Gaza, reached on January 15, 2025, brought a temporary pause to the devastating conflict between Israel and Hamas, which had persisted for over 460 days and resulted in catastrophic consequences for both sides, particularly the Palestinian population. This agreement, brokered by Qatar, Egypt, and the United States, aimed to address the immediate humanitarian crisis while attempting to de-escalate tensions and create a pathway for potential long-term peace. However, while the ceasefire provided some relief, it also underscored the enduring challenges of resolving such a deeply entrenched conflict. One of the most significant components of the ceasefire was the prisoner exchange. Hamas agreed to release 33 Israeli captives, including women, children, and elderly civilians, who had been taken during the initial Hamas-led attack on October 7, 2023. In return, Israel committed to releasing a larger number of Palestinian prisoners, including individuals serving life sentences and many who had been detained in the aftermath of the October 7 attacks. This exchange was viewed as a critical first step in building a fragile level of trust between the two sides, though its implementation was met with skepticism by those questioning whether it would lead to more substantive changes. Another crucial aspect of the ceasefire involved a partial withdrawal of Israeli military forces from northern Gaza, where heavy bombardments and ground operations had caused unprecedented destruction. Israel agreed to reposition its forces no more than 700 meters within Gaza's borders, effectively reducing its military presence in densely populated areas. However, certain strategically significant zones, such as the militarized Netzarim corridor, were excluded from the withdrawal and slated for discussion in subsequent negotiations. This limited withdrawal allowed some displaced Palestinians to return to their neighborhoods, though the widespread destruction meant that many found their homes completely leveled, leaving them without shelter or resources. The agreement also focused on addressing the dire humanitarian crisis in Gaza, which had worsened throughout the conflict. One key provision allowed for the significant scaling up of humanitarian aid, with up to 600 trucks carrying essential supplies, including food, medicine, and clean water, permitted to enter Gaza daily. Additionally, the Rafah crossing with Egypt was reopened, enabling the evacuation of injured Palestinians to receive medical treatment and allowing more aid to flow into the region. These measures were critical in alleviating immediate suffering, although logistical challenges and damage to infrastructure hindered the efficient distribution of aid. Despite these steps, the ceasefire faced substantial criticism for its temporary nature and failure to address the root causes of the conflict. The agreement did not tackle key issues such as the long-standing blockade on Gaza, which has severely restricted the movement of people and goods, nor did it resolve territorial disputes or provide a pathway for addressing broader political grievances. Critics also pointed out the imbalance in the terms of the agreement, noting that while Israel retained control over several key areas and much of the aid distribution process, Palestinians continued to suffer from systemic challenges and limited autonomy. The response from the international community to the ceasefire was mixed. Some praised the agreement as a necessary step toward reducing violence and addressing the humanitarian crisis, while others viewed it as an insufficient measure that merely postponed further conflict. Activists and human rights organizations called for greater accountability for the war crimes committed during the conflict and emphasized the need for a more comprehensive and equitable resolution. Protests and demonstrations around the world highlighted public frustration with the lack of tangible progress and the ongoing suffering in Gaza. The ceasefire, though a welcome reprieve from the violence, left many questions unanswered. The destruction in Gaza was immense, with tens of thousands dead and critical infrastructure in ruins. Rebuilding efforts were daunting, and the humanitarian crisis persisted, compounded by shortages of basic necessities. The temporary nature of the agreement and the absence of mechanisms to address the underlying causes of the conflict left the region vulnerable to future escalations. Ultimately, while the ceasefire brought brief relief, it served as a stark reminder of the urgent need for long-term solutions to achieve sustainable peace and prevent further tragedies. The ceasefire in Gaza, established on January 15, 2025, was broken on March 18, 2025, when Israel resumed its military operations, launching a series of airstrikes and ground offensives across the Gaza Strip. The breakdown of the ceasefire stemmed from escalating tensions and disagreements over the terms of the agreement, particularly regarding the release of hostages and the continuations of negotiations. Israel justified its actions by claiming that Hamas had refused to release additional hostages as part of the second phase of the ceasefire agreement. The original deal had included a phased approach, with Hamas releasing 25 hostages and the bodies of 8 others in exchange for nearly 1,800 Palestinian prisoners during the first phase. The second phase was intended to involve the release of all remaining hostages and the establishment of a permanent ceasefire. However, Israel claimed that Hamas rejected a proposal to extend the ceasefire for 50 days without clear commitments to further negotiations. The truth is that Netanyahu resumed bombing Gaza to avoid appearing in court for his corruption charges. Israel accused Hamas of rearming and preparing for new attacks during the ceasefire, which it cited as justification for preemptive strikes. The resumption of hostilities led to devastating consequences, with over 400 Palestinians killed in a single night of airstrikes targeting civilians and tent areas, makeshift shelters, and schools. The humanitarian situation in Gaza worsened significantly, with many wounded unable to access medical care due to the destruction of infrastructure and lack of fuel. The collapse of the ceasefire highlighted the fragile nature of the agreement and the deep mistrust between the parties, as well as the challenges of achieving lasting peace in the region. Since Israel shattered the ceasefire in Gaza, the consequences have been devastating and far-reaching. Over 1,300 Palestinians have been killed, and more than 3,000 have been wounded in relentless airstrikes and military operations. The violence has displaced over 280,000 people, forcing them into ever-shrinking humanitarian zones that Israel continues to target with bombings. These so-called humanitarian zones offer no safety, as they are subjected to ongoing attacks, leaving civilians trapped in a cycle of fear and destruction. Schools repurposed as shelters have come under heavy attack in recent days, resulting in tragic losses. On April 3, 2025, an airstrike on Dar al-Arkam School in the Tufa neighborhood of northeastern Gaza City claimed 31 lives and left another 70 wounded. Among the missing are 6 individuals, including a woman who was 9 months pregnant with twins. Mere minutes after this devastating attack, another strike targeted Fayed al-Saba School in the same neighborhood, killing 3 people. Children accounted for more than half of the casualties in both bombings, highlighting the unimaginable toll on Gaza's youngest and most vulnerable. An Israeli army spokesperson has alleged that Hamas utilized schools as command and control centers, a claim frequently made but often without accompanying evidence. More than two-thirds of the Gaza Strip is now under active displacement orders, or has been designated by the Israeli military as a no-go zone, effectively rendering vast areas uninhabitable. This systematic displacement has created a dire humanitarian crisis, with families forced to abandon their homes, if any left, and seek refuge in overcrowded open shelters that lack basic necessities. The situation is further exacerbated by Israel's complete blockade of humanitarian aid to Gaza, which has persisted for over 6 weeks. This blockade has prevented the entry of food, medical supplies, and other essential resources, plunging the population into a state of malnutrition and starvation. The impact of these actions is felt most acutely by Gaza's vulnerable populations, including children, the elderly, and the sick, who are unable to access the care and support they desperately need. Hospitals are overwhelmed, operating without adequate supplies or electricity, while clean water and sanitation facilities are virtually non-existent. The blockade has also hindered international aid organizations from providing relief, leaving Gaza isolated and its residents abandoned to their fate. Earlier this week, Netanyahu announces a full attack on Rafah, as if it hasn't been bombed enough. Americans are so badly misinformed. This is a world war, Holocaust level. Crime and our tax money is fully funding it. The ongoing crisis underscores the pressing need for international intervention to address the humanitarian catastrophe and ensure accountability for those responsible. The world must face the harsh realities of life in Gaza and take decisive steps toward a resolution that prioritizes civilian protection and the restoration of fundamental human rights. Yet, the global response has largely been one of silence. Now we will listen to Diana Butu reporting from This is Palestine podcast. The short clip highlights the criminal action towards the paramedics.
يما سامحيني يما هذه هي الطريقة اللي اخترتها يما إن أساعد الناس سامحيني يما يما سامحيني والله ما قصدي
Forgive me mom, this is the path I chose. I wanted to save lives. These are the final words of Rifat Radwan, a Palestinian paramedic with the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. He said these final words while recording a video on his phone as he came under an Israeli attack. The phone was found in his pocket when rescue workers recovered his dead body. Rifat's body was discovered buried in a shallow, unmarked mass grave in Rafah, in southern Gaza. He was one of 15 paramedics and emergency responders who were shot and buried by Israeli soldiers while on a mission to save lives. On March 23rd, 2025, Rifat joined a rescue convoy after Israeli bombs hit the Hashashin area of Rafah. But instead of rescuing those hit by Israeli bombs, the rescuers themselves became targets. For over a week, no one knew of their whereabouts. It was only after a week and after digging that they were found. The Israeli army had killed 15 paramedics at point-blank range, firing over 100 rounds at them. And in order to cover it up, the army then buried them in a mass, unmarked grave alongside their emergency ambulance vehicle. Today's episode unpacks these events. Rifat Radwan captured the attack on his phone, and using this video, as well as the account of the sole survivor, Mundir Abid, we piece together the story of what became of Israel's deadly ambush on Palestinian humanitarian workers. We also hear from Nubal Farsakh, the spokesperson for the Palestinian Red Crescent Society. She tells about Israel's horrific attack on her colleagues and their demand that Israel be held to account for the murder of their colleagues, alongside more than 1,000 Palestinian rescue and medical workers who have been killed by Israel. Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm Diana Butu. We begin with Mundir Abir. He's been a volunteer paramedic since 2015. He is the sole survivor of this attack on the rescue team. And he tells us that he and his colleagues were responding to a plea for help after an Israeli airstrike hit a home in the Hashashin neighborhood of Rafah.
We received a call from our dispatch center that Al-Hashashin neighborhood in Rafah had been targeted. We left the UK field hospital where our Red Crescent team was stationed. I was with my colleagues, paramedic Iz Shahat and ambulance driver Mustafa Khafaji. I was the third person in the ambulance, and I was sitting in the back.
The area the paramedics were heading to was classified as a, quote, humanitarian zone. We hear that all so often. A green zone, where civilians were present, and there were no active Israeli military operations taking place. It was not a red zone, which meant that the rescue team did not require prior coordination with the Israeli military to access the site. There were no visible Israeli military vehicles in the area, reinforcing the assumption that it was safe for emergency responders to try to carry out their work.
We were still on our way to the targeted location. Suddenly, heavy gunfire directly targeted our car. The moment the shooting started, I ducked into the back of the vehicle without thinking, trying to protect myself. I didn't hear anything from my colleagues, only what sounded like their final gasp. I couldn't see them, and I couldn't lift my head. I was lying down, reciting the Shahada, thinking that at any moment I might be martyred, that something could happen to me.
Yet, moments later, gunfire pierced the air. The ambulance stopped, and everything was shut off. The siren stopped. The external and internal lights all went out. It was complete silence, broken only by the sound of shooting. Mundir says that he heard voices in the distance, and that he heard people speaking Hebrew outside of the door. Suddenly, the side door swung open, and he saw that there were Israeli Army Special Forces, soldiers in full military gear, armed and wearing night vision goggles. The soldiers dragged him out of the ambulance, arrested him, and assaulted him.
They pulled us out of the car and into the sand. Right away, they stripped me of all my belongings. At first, I was left completely naked. Then they gave me back my underwear. They tied my hands behind my back and they began to beat me. They cursed, spat on me, insulted me, cursed God and my religion. They used the most obscene language imaginable. They interrogated me while beating me. One soldier struck me with the butt of his gun, pressing it so hard against the back of my neck that I could barely breathe. I genuinely thought I might die. At the same time, another soldier tightened my restraints and held a dagger to my wrist. He pressed it so hard it would cut through to my arteries.
Mundir was released later that same day and describes the ordeal as one of the most harrowing experiences of his life.
I've never been through anything more difficult in my life. It was so unbearable that I found myself wishing for death, just so I wouldn't have to witness what I saw.
We spoke with Nibal Farsakh, the spokesperson for the Palestine Red Crescent Society, who explained that at the time, they had no knowledge of what had happened to the ambulance. In fact, they lost all communication with the ambulance team.
When we received the call for help that the home was bombed, two ambulances were dispatched from two different locations, from two different ambulance stations. So when one ambulance reached the location and transported the casualties to the hospital, the other ambulance did not come back. So that's why we asked the ambulance crew, after they transported the casualties to the hospital, to go and check at our colleagues in their ambulance station. And this almost like an hour after the incident happened.
speaking to us, the Palestine Red Crescent Society says that these events were a series of deliberate attacks. The first assault occurred when the ambulance that was carrying Mundir and his two colleagues was targeted while en route to evacuate the casualties from the Al Hashishin area. This was followed immediately by a direct strike on the Palestine Red Crescent Society team and the civil defense ambulance convoy, despite the teams adhering strictly to all safety protocols. The series of attacks escalated with the targeting of a fourth ambulance that was on its way to provide support to the other teams. These actions highlight a systematic effort to undermine humanitarian operations, intentionally placing aid workers in harm's way. Now, of course, since it has been uncovered what happened to these paramedics, the Israeli military, as is always the case, they claim that they opened fire because the vehicles were, quote, advancing suspiciously, unquote, on nearby troops without headlights or emergency signals. But of course, the video footage that was recovered reveals the exact opposite. In the 19-minute-long video filmed from inside their moving vehicle, it shows a red fire engine and clearly marked ambulances driving at night with headlights and flashing emergency lights. The video captures the moment the convoy stops beside another vehicle that had driven off the road. Paramedics, including Arafat, exit the vehicle to assess the situation. Then gunfire erupts for 5 non-stop minutes before the screen goes black.
And in the video, you see a convoy of ambulances, 2 Palestine Red Crescent ambulances, along with 1 ambulance for the civil defense and the firefighter truck. So they moved towards the targeted ambulance in order to help our injured colleagues. And this is the time when Israeli soldiers opened heavy gunfire at the convoy of ambulances, which killed everyone. And this is the second target, by the way, because the last target was for the backup ambulance, which is the 4th ambulance that came into the location from the different route.
The video clearly depicts emergency workers in uniform driving marked ambulances and fire trucks with their lights flashing as they were targeted by Israeli gunfire.
Our colleagues were clearly marked, visibly identified as medics, driving ambulances with flashing emergency lights and heading to evacuate the wounded. What we saw was not a tragic mistake. It was a deliberate targeting. The footage documented by our late colleague, Rifat Radwan, shows the moment of our team came under direct fire, despite following all humanitarian protocols. For us, it's not just a footage. It is heartbreaking final moments of our brave medics and a horrific reminder that wearing the Red Crescent emblem no longer guarantees protection.
The horror did not end there. For an entire week, Palestinians were searching for these rescue workers. And it was only on March the 30th that the bodies of 14 individuals, including Palestine Red Crescent Society medics, civil defense staff, and 1 UNRWA worker were discovered, discarded, together in a black mesh bag buried in a mass grave. The scene is a chilling testament to the brutality, violation of human dignity, that no words can fully capture. Witnesses who helped recover the bodies shared that all the ambulance and rescue workers had been buried under dirt, with the ambulances themselves also buried. This deliberate effort to destroy the vehicles and to target the rescue teams reflects the sickness and the evil of these Israeli soldiers and of a system that's designed to undermine humanitarian aid and prevent those providing critical care from being able to carry out their work. It's designed to terrify. There is one Palestinian paramedic who has been missing since last month. The fate of Asad Nasasra remained unknown until April 13th when the Palestinian Red Crescent Society received confirmation by the ICRC, that's the International Committee of the Red Cross, that he's currently being imprisoned by Israel. Mundir recalls seeing Asad during their arrest. Asad, like Mundir, was bound, blindfolded, and stripped, except for his underwear.
We are calling for an independent international investigation to ensure those responsible are held accountable. This was not a random incident. As I said, it was a series of targeted attacks on clearly marked ambulances and medical teams. We are coordinating with international organizations to demand justice for our colleagues to ensure such atrocities are never ever repeated. We are also demanding the immediate release of our medic Asad al-Nasasra, who up to this moment is still, his whereabouts is unknown.
Since the beginning of the genocide in Gaza, Israel has systematically targeted members working in the healthcare and humanitarian services sector, including paramedics in both the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. This includes shooting at ambulances, destroying medical vehicles with airstrikes or gunfire, arresting or assaulting paramedics and doctors. It also includes bombing hospitals. Israeli forces have repeatedly attacked these teams, hindering their ability to provide emergency medical care. Paramedics have faced restrictions in their movement due to blockades and checkpoints, often being denied access to critical areas in the Gaza Strip. Over the past 18 months, Israeli forces have killed at least 1,000 healthcare workers in Gaza, including 408 rescue workers and at least 280 UNRWA staff. The Israeli army has already killed 34 members of the Palestine Red Crescent Society. These are rescue workers. The toll is not just in numbers. It's deeply human and painfully personal. Each aid and healthcare worker has a story, and each of them has people who love them and who they loved. They dedicated their lives to protecting and serving their people. This is not only a serious violation of international law, it's deeply immoral. And yet, here we are without any accountability.
Well, the repeated targeting for our teams has made it almost impossible to safely respond to emergencies. Our medics leave every day not knowing if they will return. Despite wearing protective vests, using marked ambulances, and following coordination protocols, they are not safe. These attacks have devastated our operations, forced us to limit our responses in certain areas, and have taken an unbearable psychological toll on our staff and volunteers. Yet, despite the fear, they continue to serve because our commitment to humanity remains stronger than the threats we face. But we cannot do it alone. We need protection, and we need accountability, and we need the word to act now.
At this point, it's also important to reflect on what the Israelis have said. As is always the case, they use a playbook to address any of their war crimes. The first step in that playbook is always to deny. And so when it came to the ambulances, of course, they denied. The second step is to deflect. And in this case, they did that as well. They claimed that they, the soldiers, were coming under fire from these ambulances, and that these ambulances were not well lit. Of course, we then get to step three. And step three happens when there is video footage or eyewitness or audio recordings that contradict the Israeli narrative. And here we have the video footage of Rifat Radwan. In that video footage, it's clear that nobody is firing from these ambulances and that these ambulances were clearly lit. So step three is to issue an oops, sorry, and pretend that it will go away. And so that's precisely what the Israelis did. They issued an oops, sorry, our mistake. The problem, of course, is that it takes a great deal of evil to not only pretend that they were coming under attack and to kill these paramedics, but they then dug up a mass grave, burying not only the paramedics, but also the vehicles. And in part of their oops, sorry, was an assertion that they did this for a reason. And this is the part that is particularly sick. They claim that this is part of Israeli protocol to bury and to use mass graves in order to, get this, prevent wild animals from eating the bodies. Yeah, that's what they claim. And so you can see just how this level of evil has happened. Now, of course, there have been calls for an investigation, but as is always the case with Israel, they will claim to do some internal investigation. They will find no wrongdoing, and the issue will die. This is why the Palestine Red Crescent Society is demanding answers and accountability and is demanding a true investigation.
Reflecting on the plight of Palestinians, one might ask, hasn't the suffering been enough? Their villages and towns were destroyed, lands, farms, homes, and belongings stolen. Efforts to erase their identities and heritage have been relentless, leaving generations grappling with the loss of their cultural roots. Entire populations were forced into what feels like an open prison camp, with supplies cut off and lives disrupted. Every family has endured the loss of loved ones, and nearly every Palestinian has faced arrest, even children. The scale of tragedy leaves one questioning what more could possibly be inflicted upon them. So what's next? In my opinion, there is no next as long as we continue to accept the Israeli narrative without question and watch genocide unfold in silence. Netanyahu and his government consistently portray themselves as victims, emphasizing that Hamas initiated the attacks on Israel, using this as justification for the systematic killing of Palestinians and the destruction of their lives. This narrative conveniently ignores the broader context, including the killing of over 1,000 Palestinians between January 23, 2023, and October 6, 2023. Such selective framing raises deeper questions about accountability and the ongoing cycle of violence. The tragedy unfolding in Gaza is not just a series of isolated incidents, but a reflection of systemic issues that have persisted for decades. The silence of the international community in the face of such suffering is deafening, and the lack of action only perpetuates the injustice. This silence is not neutral, it is complicity, and complicity allows the suffering to continue. Shame on those who accept this ongoing tragedy without question, and shame on those who witness these atrocities and choose silence over action. The world must confront this injustice, for only through global solidarity and a commitment to addressing the root causes of this conflict. Enough said.
Mom, I'm so sorry, Mom. I didn't want to leave you. But I had to help them, I had to go. Mom, please forgive me if I don't come back. I chose this path, a path of healing, a path of love. They're shooting at us, Mom, they see the lights, they hear the sirens, but they don't care. No one left to tell the truth. Mom, I don't wanna leave you. Mom, forgive me. Mom, forgive me for choosing this path. killed the reporters, they killed the journalists. Now they're turning their guns on me. Mom, I think it's my time. When you find my body, bury me next to Dad and little sis. Right on our graves, they stood for what was right.
We are officially out of time. If you have any questions or would you like to support us in any way, please email me at twipodcasts@gmail.com. I would like to thank you for listening, and I would like to thank the team that is working behind the scene to make this show happen. Many thanks to Bob Funk, Stanley Robinson, Stephen Lowe, Anne Lucas, Sophia Rose Woolman, Lesh Tran, Tahani Abu Mosa, and Mohammed Al Ghul. This Week in Palestine is a production of Truth and Justice Radio, currently at the home of WZBC Student Radio at Boston College. As always, we thank you for spending your time with us today as we continue to work towards Palestinian liberation. Goodbye, and see you next week.
إني أساعد الناس. سامحيني يمه. يمه سامحيني. والله ما أقصد.
Forgive me, Mom. This is the path I chose. I wanted to save lives.
Mom, I'm so sorry, Mom. I didn't want to leave you, but I had to help them. I had to go. Mom, please forgive me if I don't come back. I chose this path, a path of healing, a path of love. They're shooting at us, Mom, they see the lights, they hear the sirens, but they don't care, no, they don't care. My friends are gone, the witnesses too, no one left to tell the truth. They killed the reporters, they killed the journalists. Now they're turning their guns on me. Mom, I think it's my time. When you find my body, bury me next to Dad and little sis. Right on our graves, they stood for what was right.